Day, 24-2068, Salgado v. Smith.
Have a nice day.
Ms. Barkley, when you're ready to proceed.
I'd like to use reserve 4 minutes of rebuttal, if I may.
You've seen how that works.
Okay. It's less than five. Good morning, Judge Hartz, Judge Phillips, and Judge Ide. I'm Jamison Barkley. I'm here on behalf of plaintiff appellant Angelique Salgado, the mother of Jonathan Molina. Angelique Salgado is here with us today. We're here to ask the court to reverse the district court because a reasonable officer would know that when a suspect is subdued, you don't shoot again. Jonathan Molina was killed by defendant Officer Smith at a traffic stop wherein he was the passenger. And the officer, after having shot Jonathan Molina one time in the chest, the officer stepped back behind the car. 6 to 8 seconds passed, and then he comes back and finishes the job and shoots Jonathan 7 additional times.
Comes back. Didn't he fire from the back?
Well, I'm very glad that you asked that, and I think that's really the central idea, and that's really where the district court got it wrong. If you look at the video, and I've heard you say this morning you've watched lots of videos, so I assume you have, the car that was stopped was a Honda del Sol. It's a tiny car. It's a blue car. It's got 2 seats in it. And the officer, after, with a little leeway, I'm going to show you kind of how the action unfolded. The officer is here at the passenger window. And as you may have seen in the record, he gets inside the passenger compartment. There's a scuffle.
I want to have this recorded.
Okay, thank you. There's a scuffle. The officer is inside the passenger compartment for a minute, and during that time, he's punching Jonathan. And we know that Jonathan died not only of the gunshot wounds, but of blunt force trauma. A gun goes off. There's no evidence of intentional discharge. The officer emerges from the passenger compartment, shoots Jonathan. He's holding him down with his left hand. He shoots him with his right hand in the chest. He steps back. And he steps back along the passenger side of the car. He goes to the back of the car. These 6 to 8 seconds pass. Excuse me. While he's at the back of the car, he says in his testimony that he determined to end the threat.
Better if you speak at the podium.
Sure. He says he determined to end the threat. So he's at the back of the car, and he steps out, and he fires here. Here, 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 7 times. So he's actually, as he's firing, he's walking alongside the passenger side of the car. And the passenger door is open.
The officer's been shot already, too.
The officer was shot. Inside, while he's inside the passenger compartment, they're scuffling. He's hitting Jonathan. He ends up biting Jonathan. There's an unintentional, there's a discharge of a firearm.
Let's focus on the key point that you made at the outset.
Sure.
That the officer cannot shoot a suspect who's been subdued.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the question is, did he know that Salgado was subdued?
Absolutely.
Did he know when he shot Salgado that Salgado was mortally wounded?
Looking at the video, Your Honor, he, of course he knew that. He, again, like I said, he's holding him with one hand and he shoots him down at the chest. The testimony is he shoots down into Mr. Molina's center mass, high center mass. That's where they're trained to shoot. And the evidence in the record, we know Jonathan Molina had two gunshot wounds to the chest. So one, that first one hit the chest. The officer sees the impact of that. He steps again, steps away.
And then after 6 seconds.
Six to eight seconds.
Then he says, come out with your hands up or something like that. What's he say?
After he's shot.
After the first shot, before the next six. He says something to Salgado, does he not?
No, he does not say anything before the second shot. He just starts shooting. He's at the back of the car. He takes one shot through the small passenger, the rear window. He takes a shot, and he just keeps shooting.
He didn't say one word about come out, drop your gun and come out or anything?
No, like I do believe he was yelling. There were some curse words. If you've seen the video, the audio is very garbled, so you can catch a word every now and then. So he was screaming. He was yelling something.
He was yelling, show me your hands, which is how you don't get shot, as if the other person shows their hands.
Sure, but...
And no hands were shown.
Well, but that's not exactly right.
Okay.
Because what happened was, at the beginning, he can't see the hands, but as he's walking around here, the passenger door is open. The officer testified at his statement, statement that he gave that morning, that he saw Jonathan... that Jonathan was not trying to escape out of the vehicle, and that he did not see that small caliber weapon.
But shouldn't the officer in that situation, this very unfortunate situation, shouldn't the officer be concerned that been shot once could be shot again?
Sure, Your Honor, but there has to be an analysis. That's just not, you can't just say, okay.
You don't have a lot of time.
Well, but he had 6 to 8 seconds, and that's more than in Fancher. In Fancher, the officer had 5 to 7 seconds. Here we have more time.
That was daylight.
Okay.
And he saw him slump.
But, you know, Your Honor, a jury could see the video in this case and ascertain that the officer saw Jonathan slump as well.
So
he was so close to him, Your Honor. He couldn't have not seen that.
What should the officer have done, knowing that ambulance service is required?
Sure. After he shot Jonathan the first time?
Yes.
He should remain in cover. He should deal with the driver because he said he had a fear about the driver. So handle the other person. He should call for backup. That's the first thing he done. He'd never even called for backup at this point. Well,
but you can't wait for sunrise. You've got a man who's bleeding and you're not going to send the ambulance workers in there not knowing if the guy has a gun and he's still conscious. So I don't see the good answer here for what is supposed to happen.
Sure. Well, I guess what I would say is I don't think that the record is clear that he didn't see the suspect. He saw the suspect. He was within a couple of feet of the suspect.
What about the report? Did he not testify, and doesn't his... He had a body cam on?
No. Okay. I wish he did. There was a dash cam.
Okay. Does the dash cam show that Mr. Salgado stuck a foot out of the door after he was shot?
What the dash cam shows is it's a foot flopping. It's an involuntary movement. And what I would direct the court's attention to is...
How is that visible? What shows... You're looking at some sort of video that shows his foot flopping. What is that video?
Okay, so there's one primary video in this case. It was the dash cam of the police unit.
And that vehicle's in back of the...
Yes, so if you look at the video, everything is from the rear of the blue Honda.
Okay, so does that... So that... the dash cam on the police vehicle does show Mr. Salgado's foot. Is there anything else of Mr. Salgado's that appears outside the vehicle? It goes out the right front door?
No. It's actually Mr. Salgado, you barely see him. Well, he was in the passenger compartment the whole time until then his body's getting dragged out. I do want to say that in the statement that he gave to the investigating officers the morning of the shooting, he said that, again, he saw Mr. Molina. And this is in the record at 2:30. It's also in the record at 2:32. He saw Mr. Molina, and this is, again, it makes sense because we know that he moved from the back of the car. And the car, if you look at the record.
Well, don't you want him to move from the back of the car and be craning his neck to see if there's, if he's conscious or something? In other words, as soon as he saw, he stopped firing.
No. That's not right. We'd have a very different case if that were the, if that were right. That's not at all what happened.
So you're maintaining that the record shows that after the gunshot where the officer is struck and he goes to the back of the car and he begins to swing around after I guess you're not saying he yelled, put your hands up. But as he makes his way around counterclockwise, firing the weapon, that he continues to fire the weapon after he sees.
That's what our whole case is about.
All right.
That's the case. And looking at, again, the statement he gave the morning of, he says, I pied to the right side of the vehicle so I could see him better. So he moves from directly behind the little Honda to over here. Again, the door's open. Mr. Molina is sitting there with a gunshot in the chest.
Well, is he sitting there or is he lying across the front seat in some fashion?
Well, we don't know. But I'll tell you, actually, I guess I shouldn't say we don't know, because when asked, the officer said he saw them sitting there. I saw him still sitting in the vehicle. And the agent, the state police, said, what was he doing? Did you see a firearm at that point? I don't recall. I can't tell you what he was doing with it or where exactly it was at.
But where does he say, and I continued to fire?
Well, we know he continued to fire because of the video. And if you, and again, the statement is very pivotal. It's before he had counsel, before his lawyer wrote him a 13-page affidavit to explain, you know, the best case scenario. He tells the investigators that morning that he ended the deadly threat, is what he said. And he decided when he was at the rear of the vehicle, before he decided to end the deadly threat here. So he starts shooting, and he's seeing as he comes around. He's telling the investigator that morning, as I'm pieing around, I saw Jonathan, I saw him sitting, and I didn't see a gun.
There's gunfire exchanged, and watching the video, you see traffic going by. Is that a concern, that an innocent motorist is going to get one?
Well, I think that would be a concern on the part of the citizenry against the officer. The officer is just firing wildly.
Well, he doesn't shoot while a car goes by.
Well, but he gets an awful lot of shots off, doesn't he? And I think you're right, and it's important to consider they are along I-25, the interstate, and the car was, when the stop was initiated, the driver pulled between an exit ramp and the southbound lanes. So he's in the area of the highway that's like hashed, striped, and there's traffic going by. But the officer never articulated any fear about surrounding folks. So that's not an issue here, Your Honor. The officer, by his own words, he said, it was not based on any new information, any new calculation of a threat. We know that the law requires that officers reconsider the use for lethal force when a suspect is subdued. And Fancher, the Fancher case is directly on point here. In the Fancher case, the officer shot the suspect also in the chest at close range. Similarly, he was standing outside the vehicle with the suspect in the vehicle, just like our case. There were actually two loaded weapons because in that case, the suspect was in the police vehicle. So in Fancher, there were two loaded weapons in the passenger compartment.
Long guns.
Long guns.
So which are much easier to see if you're going to get shot with a long gun in the daylight.
Sure, Your Honor. But the point is that there was weapon in the passenger compartment. And so the mere existence of a weapon in the passenger compartment does not provide for additional use of force after he was subdued. He's shot in the chest. The officer had more time than in Fancher. The affidavit in this case is an improper attempt to insert the officer's subjective impressions of what happened. We know it's foundational that the standard of review is what would an objective officer do, an objectively well-trained officer. And we know that the case law says, our case law is replete with the requirement that police officers recalculate the need for lethal force. And when a suspect has been subdued, you don't shoot again. What are we doing then? He's murdering this young man.
I'm still searching for the answer to that question, which I agree is the correct one, which is, what would a reasonable officer do, and what is reasonably objective conduct that we tolerate? Take cover, you said. So go behind the patrol car and crouch, and then what?
No, I mean, he had cover behind the Honda.
Well,
so he was
you could
here.
Get shot. You could get shot.
Backup. How about start with that?
Okay,
backup.
But I still don't know how that solves the problem, because the clock is ticking and a man is apparently mortally wounded, and so you're just going to wait it out?
Well, that's a different concern, right, saving the life, but I think in the immediacy, you call backup, and I'm looking at this car, and there's nothing happening.
So what
you
does...
You can see in the video, there's screaming. Jonathan's screaming, and
what,
that's it.
What does backup do? Join him crouching behind the automobile?
No, Your Honor. No. Then they secure the driver. And I mean, by this point, then the officer is not feeling, I don't think, as if he needed to use that lethal force when he had backup. I mean, I don't know. I think he went off the rails a long time before these seven shots in terms of what would a reasonable officer do. A reasonable officer doesn't get in the passenger compartment of a two-seater car. A reasonable officer doesn't bite. A reasonable officer, again, doesn't say, okay, I'm going to go back and shoot another seven times to a man I just hit in the chest. And again, there's not like a bank robbery here. There's not a kidnapping. There's not a rape. He's a passenger.
Your time's expired.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
I have a question, though.
Yes.
You said something about Mr. Salgado screaming.
Yes.
How long in the sequence was he screaming? Was he screaming just before the second group of shots? Had he quit screaming by then?
No, my recollection is he started screaming on the second through eighth shots.
Okay.
As he's getting fired on and it's kind of coming around, you know,
he's screaming. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, just based on the officer's own testimony, that's reasonable jury could conclude with that and looking at the video. That this just was not reasonable. We don't allow this.
Your time's expired.
Thank you.
Mr. Robles.
May it please the court, my name is Luis Robles, and I represent the appellee in this case, Officer Kevin Smith. I wanted to begin with making three points, but I recognize that the exchange that was had moments ago caused me to pivot and to answer a central question that you, Judge Hartz, had identified. And that is exactly what was happening right after that first shot was fired, and then ultimately when the volley of seven rounds then began. Now, fortunately, we have a video so we can actually see what the officer is doing. And what's important about that first shot, and I want to say something else that's, I think, vitally important. In the district court, we argued that all of the use of force, the punching, the biting, the efforts that that Officer Kevin Smith tried to use in order to gain custody of this man was objectively reasonable to include that first shot. The estate in the below abandoned those claims, and thus what we're left with is the acknowledgement that that use of force was constitutional. And the judge, Judge Herrera below, says as much. Here, plaintiff does not dispute Officer Smith's arguments that he did not violate the Fourth Amendment during the first part of his struggle with Mr. Molina. That is when he punched Mr. Molina in the head, bit his arm, and fired his first shot at Mr. Molina. Rather, plaintiff argues that Officer Smith violated Mr. Molina's right to be free from excessive use of force when he shot Mr. Molina 7 additional times after the shooting him for the first time. So there is this grand concession that everything leading up to those 7 shots was constitutional. And thus the argument that's made, especially in the reply, that Officer Smith's actions, pre-seizure actions, are reckless, must be abandoned because they gave up that argument down below. Now, moving into that central argument. So we have constitutional conduct by the officer. He fires one round. He then has a malfunction. That's why he stops firing. So, and again, I can go into mechanics, but there's no need for that. There is the effort that's undertaken to clear the malfunction, and he's also trying to move away from the simple line of fire because he has not disarmed Mr. Molina. Mr. Molina still has the gun, which he shot the officer with. And in order to lessen the threat, not eliminate the threat, but to create time, the officer moves back and away from. He gains a tactical advantage, and all that really means is he has more time to decide what to do. Now, in that time, with those 6 to 7 seconds, the officer is assessing, I have a gun that doesn't work, and he says in his deposition testimony, as well as in his police interview and in the affidavit, he did not know whether Mr. Molina had been shot or not. And we can, I can steel man.
Well, was Mr. Molina crying in pain during that time? Was he screaming in pain?
He yelled. He yelled.
Molina did.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
So wouldn't that indicate that he knew at least he'd shot him? He didn't know maybe how much Molina was injured. But if Molina screamed or yelled, wouldn't that indicate to Officer Smith that he had at least hit him with the bullet?
That would be objective evidence from which a reasonable officer might conclude that. I would agree with that. But what Officer Smith had to deal with is that he had not, and again, this is the part that I think is very interesting. We have someone who shot, and the estates claim that he was subdued. I think what they're really trying to say is incapacitated. But Officer Smith had no way to determine in this tense, uncertain situation whether one round actually incapacitated Mr. Molina such that he was no longer a threat. Again, the officer is dealing with a number of problems. I'm in the line of fire. I have a malfunction. I need to clear the malfunction and move out of this line of fire. And I think to myself, what case speaks to this more broadly? And I think of, I believe it is... Thomas versus Durastanti. There you have an agent who is facing a vehicle that's driving towards the agent. The agent is struck. He is hit. He rolls over the hood of the vehicle, and somehow he ends up standing on his feet. And as the vehicle is leaving, when the vehicle is no longer an immediate threat of serious bodily harm to the agent, he fires. And what did the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals say about the reasonableness of such a decision? Again, objectively, the vehicle was not going to strike him. It was moving away from him. But given that set of circumstances, that agent made a reasonable decision with the understanding of the really tremendous disorienting effect of being hit by a vehicle. Here we have a police officer who not only was shot, and this is all in the record, he was worried about bleeding out. Mr. Molina called out for his friend, Brandon Smith, to come and help him. So the officer had to contend with another person who might attack him from behind. And he was exhausted. That's what he faced.
I'm sorry. Who was calling out for?
Mr. Molina was calling out for the driver of the vehicle, Brandon Smith.
Okay.
And so there's two Smiths in this case, okay. The driver and the officer. And that's why I named him as Brandon. So call him Brandon. Brandon, he was calling out for Brandon to come and help while the officer has trying to hold on to his gun.
Was that before The first shot fired by the officer?
Yes, it was during the struggle when Officer Smith was trying to hold on to his own gun, keeping in the holster, and holding Mr. Molina's hand with the gun in it, trying to prevent Mr. Molina from then pointing the muzzle of the weapon and shooting the officer a second time. And I will posit this to this court. Having read all of it, this court's opinions and deadly force cases, there is no case that this court has decided where there is no more compelling set of facts. And what do I mean by that? Very bluntly, there is no case in which the violence delivered against this officer was as life-threatening and as savage as what you see in this case. So much like the agent in Thomas versus Durastanti, you had an officer who was faced with this overwhelming situation, which would disorient any one of us. And so being able to assess, did my one round not only strike, but did it incapacitate while trying to clear a malfunction and moving into a position where he had cover and concealment? That's asking an awful lot of an objectively well-trained officer to sit and wait. Because in asking an officer to wait, sit, and assess, you're asking the officer to stay in the line of fire, to essentially expose himself to being shot a second time. In this case, we know the manifest intentions of Mr. Molina. He already showed it. He shot my client. Now, the estate would have you believe that it was an accidental discharge. But that runs counter to just simple common sense. An officer is struggling with a criminal suspect who's an absconder, who's headed back to prison. He said as much. And he feels, and he hears the sound, he feels the searing pain. He thinks at first he was hit with his own taser. And then he sees, and he doesn't even understand how he got that way, he's holding Mr. Molina's hand with the gun in it. To think that the gun accidentally went off when the struggle began with the gun not being visible is asking this court to, well, accept the argument of an attorney as opposed to, you know, the facts being viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. Now, another aspect of this case, and you had asked about the Fancher case, the facts in this case are so much more compelling about the danger which Mr. Molina faced than the deputy faced in Fancher. We had a deputy in the Fancher case who saw his round cause the driver, the suspect, to slump. And then the vehicle in Fancher began to move in reverse, and the deputy testified that he felt safer. And more importantly, as the court noted in Fancher, that when the vehicle was moving away, the officer noted that the suspect was not reaching for the guns that were in the front seat. So that officer had objective information upon which he could base his decision that the suspect was no longer a deadly threat and deadly force wasn't warranted. Here we have something much, much, much more ambiguous with the underlying compelling facts that I've described for you previously and the fact that for the officer, in order to determine and put himself in a position where his safety, you know, was at least there was more safety behind the vehicle than there was next to the passenger seat, the officer could not see. But fortunately, what we have in this case from my client is he did give a verbal command. And the words are, and again, I can't say them in this courtroom, but put your frickin' hands up. And of course, he used a different word than the word that I'm using. And that happened approximately 2 to 3 seconds before the first round of the 7-round volley was fired.
Now, could he see? Just looking at the video, first of all, it's a very narrow rear view window.
Yes.
And on the video, which probably doesn't capture it exactly how it was if you're standing there, it's hard to tell if anything is in the car. It could, if he raised his hands, would the officer have seen them?
I would say no. The windows were tinted, and then you have the officer's takedown lights as well as the headlights hitting a tinted window. It's black. And so I can say that, And also the video shows that. So is it conceivable that Mr. Molina raised his hands? It's conceivable.
Well, when the foot comes out, might that have been his effort to try to raise his hands, to get out of the car and show his hands? Or is that stretching it?
The way I would think about it is that if Mr. Molina wanted to show his hands, we know he has had run-ins with the police. He was going back to prison, so it's not as if we had someone who had no understanding of how these things work in the real world. He could have put his hand or hands out of the vehicle. Instead, the leg came out.
I don't know if what his condition was, if he was capable of that, having been shot in the chest. Maybe.
If the officer knew, I would agree with you that he would not, that the officer should have waited. But because the officer didn't know, and that's what's in the record, the officer did not know whether his round struck Mr. Molina, much less that he was incapacitated by the round. You know, and then we have this whirlwind of bewildering, stressful facts that he was trying to contemplate with. He can make a mistaken decision. Maybe Mr. Molina did raise his hands. Maybe Mr. Molina did want to surrender. But as this court said in Wilson versus Meeks, you know, an officer can't look into, you can't read someone's mind or look into their heart to determine what their true intent is. All they can do is base their decision based on the objective facts that they know.
What about counsel's statement, if I understood it correctly, and if I didn't, I apologize, that the officer saw him in the car and continued to fire? What's the record show there?
The way I would have this court address that is when you look at the video, that's not what happened. It just, when you, I don't know how else to say
it. Where is he standing at the last gunshot?
So imagine, if you would, that the rearview, that the back windshield of the vehicle is the podium. And what you have before you is an officer who shoots and he moves. But he stays behind the vehicle. He does not begin to then move back into, and again, that would be reckless, to move back into a line of fire and put himself in a position where Mr. Molina could just simply raise a hand with a gun in it and shoot him.
Well, if he did, if he fired after seeing Mr. Molina splayed out or in whatever posture, would that be a Fourth Amendment violation?
It would, if only the video showed such events.
So you're saying when Officer Smith, after firing the first shot through the back window, he didn't start walking around the vehicle and shooting as he did that. He just moved over to the side of the rear. But if the vehicle's pointing north, he wasn't moving north of the backside of the vehicle, is what you're saying?
Yes, I see that my time has ended. May I answer your question? He moves at best laterally. That is east. I mean, it would be from east to west. He does not move north. You know, he does not move north and compromise his safety. That's on the video, and that I'm thankful that's what it shows.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Counsel are excused. We'll be in recess till 8:30 tomorrow morning. 9 tomorrow morning.